Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Mel Goodman, former CIA analyst and senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, who examines how the death of Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden could affect the U.S. war on terrorism and the conflict in Afghanistan. Terry O'Neill, president of the National Organization for Women, who explains why she believes the GOP-led economic assault on the middle class can be more accurately described as a war on women. And theoretical physicist and author Dr. Michio Kaku, who assesses the ongoing health threat from the disaster at Japan's Fukushima nuclear power plant complex and the debate over the government's annual allowable radiation limits. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
25 years after the Chernobyl nuclear accident, high levels of radiation are still leaking out of the damaged power plant. According to the Interpress service, the cement and steel sarcophagus built to encase the nuclear reactor has cracks and is leaking radiation at unsafe levels. A new sarcophagus to contain the damaged reactor is scheduled to be completed in 2015. It will cost a projected $2.3 billion to complete. So far, only $880 million from donors has been raised. A new health study by the German affiliate of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War estimates the nuclear accident at Chernobyl led to the death of 112,000 cleanup workers, first responders, and soldiers who tried to contain the radioactive damage. The explosion at Chernobyl's Unit 4 on April 26, 1986, led to the release of 8 tons of nuclear material that spewed across Europe. The radioactive cloud was 500 times more toxic than the atomic bomb at Hiroshima. The World Health Organization estimates that in Belarus alone, 50,000 children suffered from thyroid cancer. Globally, the United Nations projected that the Chernobyl nuclear accident caused between 30,000 and 210,000 children to be born with genetic defects. The Guardian newspaper reports that a reduction in carbon emissions by wealthy industrialized countries has been overwhelmed by carbon pollution from emerging export-driven countries like China. Under the Kyoto Protocol, which expires in 2012, carbon emissions were counted at the point of production rather than the point of consumption. Environmental activists have long complained that developed countries like the United States and European Union sent their carbon pollution offshore by relying on manufactured goods from newly industrialized economies like India, China, and Brazil. According to previous research, developed countries had reduced carbon emissions by 2% from 1990 to 2008. However, a new study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which factored in imports and excluded exports, found overall carbon emissions rose 7% since 1990. New Mexico community activist Arturo Uribe worked to blow the whistle on pollution from a fertilizer plant that was harming the lives of children in the mostly Latino town of Mesquite, New Mexico. The company sued Uribe to shut him up. Uribe first noticed pollution coming from the fertilizer processing plant owned by Helena Chemical Company when his newborn baby had respiratory problems. The baby boy needed a nebulizer to clear his lungs. Uribe also complained to the New Mexico Environmental Department about fumes coming from the plant. State environmental inspectors eventually levied over $200,000 in civil fines against Helena for violations of air quality laws. The agency also fined Helena for failing to report the spill of 500 gallons of liquid fertilizer. After filing a lawsuit against Helena for its emissions that he claimed harmed children, the company sued Uribe for defamation and harassing its employees. Helena used the civil suit to search Uribe's computers, email records, and digital photographs. In April 2010, Helena won its defamation suit against Uribe, and the judge ordered the activist to pay $75,000 in damages to the company. The damages were later reduced, and Uribe has appealed. Uribe's lawyer, Linda Thomas, told the Progressive magazine, "This decision is going to have a chilling effect on anyone in this country who wants to stop polluters in their community." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
The nation and world were caught by surprise on Sunday, May 1st, when President Obama unexpectedly appeared on television networks to announce that a special U.S. Navy SEAL assault team had raided a compound in Pakistan, killing al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. The news of bin Laden's death came almost 10 years after the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks on New York's World Trade Center towers, the Pentagon, and a crashed airliner in Pennsylvania, resulting in nearly 3,000 deaths. In cities around the country, thousands of Americans took to the streets to cheer the news of Osama bin Laden's death. Mr. Obama told Americans that the world is a better place with the death of bin Laden, even as U.S. intelligence agencies and the military prepared for the possible launch of retaliatory attacks by al-Qaeda supporters. Not long after news of bin Laden's death was announced, some members of the former Bush administration maintained that information used to locate bin Laden was obtained by torture, or what they euphemistically call harsh interrogation techniques, in an attempt to justify the controversial policy, illegal under international law, and later banned by President Obama. The justification of torture was disputed by many, including Senator Dianne Feinstein, chairwoman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who said that torture of 9/11 suspects did not aid in locating bin Laden. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Mel Goodman, a former CIA analyst, who is now a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and an adjunct professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. Goodman examines how the death of al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden may affect the U.S. war on terrorism and the conflict in Afghanistan.
I think we need to recognize that we dealt al-Qaeda a tremendous setback 10 years ago. When we went into Afghanistan and routed al-Qaeda and ultimately the Taliban, they were really dispersed. And I'm not saying they were rendered harmless in this situation, but I think they lost a lot of ability to conduct the kind of sophisticated operations that 9/11 was all about. 9/11 was an incredible operation with a lot of moving parts. Various countries were involved, Germany and Spain, the United States in terms of training. And I don't think al-Qaeda has that kind of capability anymore. And I don't think bin Laden was the operational leader of al-Qaeda in that sense, because basically he was in retreat. And I think even the fact that he was killed where he was suggests that he was still on the run, probably because of the success of the drone strikes in Waziristan in western Pakistan. I assume the leadership of al-Qaeda has had to move out of that area. Al-Qaeda people are dying on a regular basis if they're consistently being targeted. I think one of the questions it raises is to what degree did Pakistan have some knowledge that something was going on in this town, you know, less than an hour away from Islamabad, where this huge fortress went up in an area that essentially belonged to the military. There were restricted zones all over the place. The Pakistani West Point, the military academy, was located there. Retired generals have made their home there. So when you look at al-Qaeda copycat organizations in various parts of the world, Yemen, Somalia, North Africa, I think business will go on as usual, but the movement has lost its icon. They've lost the leader that they pledged support to, that they pledged fealty to. And I think on that level of recruitment, there's a possibility that without bin Laden, it's going to be much more difficult.
Mel Goodman, what, if anything, you think will change in Afghanistan, given that certainly the initial rationale for launching the war in Afghanistan was the presence of al-Qaeda in that country? More recently, the military has told us there are very few al-Qaeda operatives in Afghanistan. Does that rationale still stand up?
I think this should be an opportunity to question what we're doing in Afghanistan. I think we've come to the conclusion that there can be no military solution to the Afghan problem. And we also know and have known for a long time that there are very few members of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan in any event. The CIA director says there are fewer than 50. The head of the military operation, General David Petraeus, has used the same number and said maybe a little more than 50, but this is a totally insignificant number and doesn't command the presence of 100,000 U.S. troops. And when I think back to December of 2009, when Obama announced the huge increase in forces up to another 33,000, taking us over 100,000, he seemed extremely ambivalent. Well, if that ambivalence was real, and I think it was, I think he should hold firm to his commitment to start withdrawing troops in the summer, as he said he would. And this will be a real test, not only of Obama's relationship with the military and with the Pentagon, but his commitment to adhere to a policy that he put into effect in 2009 and even had a statement signed by all the major players in the room that they understood the policy that we were going to begin withdrawal in the summer of 2011. But we have commitments that the U.S. would be getting out of Iraq, and now you have a Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, who's saying that if Iraqis want us to stay, we'll remain in Iraq for a longer period of time. So this is a testing point for Obama, and it comes at a very difficult time because he's changed his own national security team and I think made it much weaker.
Mel Goodman, I wanted to ask you about what do you think the effect will be of bin Laden's death alongside this very unexpected set of uprisings across the Middle East and North Africa challenging U.S.-supported dictators and monarchies. Do you think al-Qaeda and these other jihadi groups have lost a lot of support that they once had in the Arab world?
Well, there's no question they've lost support, but frankly, I think the loss of support began on 9/11. 9/11 was a classic case of overreaching. They scored a great surprise and had a great success and had great euphoria over what they did on 9/11. But the fact of the matter was that's when the movement went into decline. And if you look at the terrorist operations that have taken place since 9/11, they are bizarre kinds of situations in terms of Robert Reed and the shoe bomber, Abdul Muttalib from Nigeria, and the underwear bomber. They don't seem to be recruiting the kinds of people they had in the past. And I don't see any Arab societies that are showing any grief for the loss of bin Laden. I think he was a marginal character to begin with, who then marginalized himself further on 9/11. And I think what the Arab Spring proved in terms of the series of revolutions which caught, I think, the American policy and intelligence community by surprise, certainly caught bin Laden by surprise and made it clear that he wasn't a major instrument of influence in the Middle East, that he didn't really count for that much. And what the masses wanted in the Middle East had nothing to do with bin Laden or Islamic politics. It wasn't anti-U.S. It wasn't anti-Israel. These people were fighting for basic rights and clear democratic reform. So I think the situation was changing and unfolding in a way where al-Qaeda was essentially irrelevant.
That was Mel Goodman, a former CIA analyst and senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. His forthcoming book is titled National Insecurity, The Threat of American Militarism. Find links to Goodman's recent articles on our website at btlonline.org. With Republicans in leadership in the U.S. House of Representatives and a majority of states in the hands of Republican governors and legislatures, budget cuts and policy changes are being proposed, and in many cases passed, that disproportionately impact women, especially women of color. At the federal level, Representative Paul Ryan, Republican of Wisconsin, won passage in the House of his 2012 budget proposal that would convert Medicare from a program in which the government pays medical bills of senior citizens over 65 years of age into a voucher system that provides inadequate subsidies to purchase private insurance coverage. The GOP budget would also make major cuts to social safety net programs, such as food stamps, and impose a 35% cut on Medicaid and turn the program into state-administered block grants. In contrast to the deep cuts, Ryan's budget reduces the tax burden on the nation's wealthiest citizens and big corporations. On April 28th, activists organized by the National Organization for Women, or NOW, staged a dozen protest actions around the country, sending a message to politicians that women do not want to work until they die. NOW opposes Ryan's budget that would dismantle Medicare and turn Medicaid into block grants, and other proposals that would increase the Social Security retirement age to 69 years. Terry O'Neill, the president of NOW, says while the media and Democratic politicians refer to these actions as a war on the middle class, she says it's more accurate to call it a war on women. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with O'Neill about the different elements of the GOP-led economic assault and what NOW is doing to challenge these policies.
The budget is part and parcel, in my view, of this war on women, because other people have called it a war on the middle class, but be very clear, middle class women work a lifetime at unequal pay, and they are the ones that are most vulnerable in any attacks on middle class programs. And so it is a war on women to attack the middle class. On ideological grounds, right-wingers in the Congress are attacking women's ability to get not just abortion care, but an entire range of reproductive health care services. That's on ideological grounds. On budget grounds, just on pure allocation of resources around the country, conservatives in Congress are slashing programs that disproportionately serve women. And a lot of people don't understand this, but those programs that are being slashed disproportionately employ women as well as disproportionately serving women. So Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, women, infant, and children's nutrition programs, food stamps, Pell grants, other training programs, prenatal care programs, family planning clinics, all of these disproportionately employ women as well as disproportionately serving women. So we really are facing a situation where women are getting slammed first and foremost by these men who are at the same time increasing expenditures for the military, which disproportionately employs men. They are talking about entrenching tax breaks for the wealthiest billionaires who are not women. They are very disproportionately men. So it's very much, in my view, a gender-based war on the middle class.
Although women make more than the 59 cents to every dollar earned by men in the 1960s, women now make only 77 cents for every dollar earned by men. What's the impact of that over time?
The reason that women are so vulnerable to these cuts, it goes right back to unequal pay. So workplaces in this country are severely sex segregated, and women cluster in jobs that don't have pensions and they're not represented by unions. So after a lifetime of working at unequal pay, women head into their retirement years with very little in the way of saving. Single women of color, about half, head into their retirement years with zero to negative net worth. And white women who are single head into their retirement years, on average, with a net worth of only $41,000. It's estimated that because of unequal pay, a woman loses, depending on her level of education and what industry she works in, that she will lose between $400,000 and $2 million in her lifetime. Now, how many kids could you put through college without debt with that $1 million that you didn't get because people are not obeying the law?
Terry O'Neill now is famous for organizing some of the biggest mass protests in American history. How are you responding to the current crisis?
Yeah, we've been very aggressive at organizing at the community level. We just had an incredibly successful series of demonstrations around the country. We're working in coalition, and the theme of the past 2 weeks of demonstrations was "Don't make us work till we die." This is a protest against the proposals to increase the retirement age to 69. You know, the average nurse lifts over 1 ton per day, and the average nurse cannot work to the age of 69. Which means that when she has to take quote-unquote early retirement at 63 or 64 or 65, anyone who takes early retirement, their benefits are cut for the rest of their life. That's their Social Security benefits as well as the pension if they're lucky enough to have a pension. So we've been engaged in the Don't Make Us Work Till We Die protests around the country. We are currently engaged in a massive contact your senator, contact your representative effort to stop these outrageous cuts to all of these programs. Frankly, Representative Paul Ryan, who produced the House Leadership 2012 budget plan with their proposal to voucherize Medicare, which simply means that grandma gets a voucher and grandma's told it doesn't matter how sick you get, grandma, once you've used up your vouchers, you don't have any more health care. We're sorry, you're done.
That was Terry O'Neill, president of the National Organization for Women. To learn more about NOW's campaign, visit our website at btlonline.org. The March 11th Japanese earthquake and tsunami that killed 14,700 people and left an estimated 11,000 missing also destroyed the Fukushima nuclear power plant complex in the north of the country. On April 21st, the Japanese government evacuated residents living within a 20-kilometer radius of the disabled nuclear complex and barred them from returning to their homes due to increased levels of radiation. Utility workers have been struggling to repair the cooling systems of Fukushima's three stricken reactors, but high levels of radiation have prevented workers from entering the reactor buildings. But in recent days, fans with filters are being deployed to reduce radiation levels inside the reactor buildings necessary to allow repair crews to begin their work. Officials of the Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO, which owns the Fukushima complex, has said it may take the rest of the year to regain control of the broken reactors. Open displays of dissent within the Japanese government are rare, but that changed on April 30th when senior nuclear advisor Toshiso Kosako, a professor at the University of Tokyo's graduate school, held a press conference to resign his post over his disagreement with the government's level of allowable radiation exposure. Kosako quit in protest over the government's April 19th decision to set the annual radiation limit at 20 millisieverts per year for infants, toddlers, and primary school students. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dr. Michio Kaku, theoretical physicist and author, who is a professor at the City College of New York. Dr. Kaku assesses the ongoing health threat from the disaster at the failed Fukushima nuclear reactors and the debate over the government's annual allowable radiation limits.
The reactors, they say, are stable, but I think of them as a ticking time bomb, which is also relatively stable. And they figure that in 6 to 9 months, in the best-case scenario, they'll be able to relieve the brave firemen who are shooting hose water, into these nuclear power plants, keeping them safe. And in 6 to 9 months, automatic pumps will be turned on to relieve these heroic firemen who are like samurai warriors. Some of them are not going to come back alive. Radiation levels are huge at the site, lethal, in fact, in some areas. In about 1 hour, you get the radiation sickness, in fact. You start to vomit, your hair falls out. You have premature aging and death within a few hours. That's how lethal the radiation field is. And then Hitachi Corporation says, in a best-case scenario, 30 years to complete the dismantling of the melted cores and seal the whole thing in concrete. That's the best-case scenario. The worst-case scenario is that we have another small earthquake. Now, remember, we're going to have secondary earthquakes for another year. And if they have to evacuate the firemen and the crew on site, then there's no more cooling water to keep the reactors cool, and then the meltdown starts all over again.
In terms of low-level radiation, which is a growing concern in Japan and around the world, there's somewhat of a debate. You hear many officials and utility power company people around the world, certainly in Japan, reassuring the public that low levels of radiation are not really a problem. But, of course, there are many different opinions, and a senior nuclear advisor to the Japanese Prime Minister, Naoto Kan, resigned, saying the government radiation limits would not protect school children living in northern Japan, nor did he approve of increasing the rates that workers on site at Fukushima could absorb.
The reason why this gentleman quit, which is unprecedented, by the way, these panels are usually rubber-stamped panels that agree with the government. They're like a bunch of yes men. So for him to actually quit and denounce the utility and the government plans is quite extraordinary. And he basically said that children will be getting the same radiation dose as atomic workers. And atomic workers, in turn, get many times the dose that an ordinary adult gets. And he said that this is unconscionable. Now, the reason why the government and the utility went along with this recommendation, of course, is because of money. Right now, the cleanup costs are around $300 billion, making it the most expensive natural disaster in history. And if they have to keep on expanding the evacuation zone, then, of course, it's going to cost more money to resettle these people and pay for property damage. But my attitude is, think of the much larger economic impact you're going to have if these people come down with cancer. They're going to sue the government, and there are going to be a lot of epidemiologists who will back their lawsuit. when these people begin to come down with leukemia in 5 years and solid tumors in 10 to 15 years, there are going to be a lot of lawsuits from these kids and unnecessary cancers. The utility has a long history of cover-ups. In fact, there was a huge cover-up that took place about 10 years ago, very, very bad accident that was completely covered up by the utility. You have to remember that the utility made a fatal mistake. They did not take into account the 100-year storm, as we call it, tsunamis that take place on a scale of 100 years. The walls at the reactor site were 15 feet tall. The tsunami that hit that wall was 45 feet tall, overwhelmed the reactor, and then the generators and backup pumps were put in the basement. I can't think of anything sillier than putting the backup pumps and the fail-safe system in the basement of a nuclear power plant. So all the safety systems got knocked out in the opening minutes of the accident. And that's why all three cores went into a partial meltdown mode within hours of that. And in fact, Unit 2 probably has a breach of containment. Now, if you look at Chernobyl as an example, the dead zone around Chernobyl is about 19 miles in radius, and that area is still radioactive. In fact, if you die of radiation poisoning, your grave will be radioactive for centuries, even though you're long gone and dead. Your gravesite will be radioactive. And so the dead zone is incredible around Chernobyl. In Japan, 10% of the radiation of Chernobyl came out, so the dead zone will be smaller. But still, we're talking about the loss of livelihood. The economic area is going to be totally devastated. Who's going to want to live right next to that area? Who's going to want to buy a product that comes from that area?
That was Dr. Michio Kaku, theoretical physicist, co-founder of string field theory, and a professor at the City College of New York. His newest book is titled Physics of the Future. Visit our website to find links to Dr. Kaku's latest articles and other information on the Fukushima disaster at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.